Erica Wilkinson, and this is the Doc Sounds of Science podcast. Kia ora, ko Erica Wilkinson tēnei. He kona I purangi tēnei e pa ana ki ngā Sounds of Science. Every episode, we talk about work being done behind the scenes by Doc's technical experts, scientists, rangers, and the experts in between. This is part two of our interview with renowned kākāpō scientist, Dr. Andrew Digby. In part one, Andrew shared so many great stories about the intensive kākāpō breeding season, fascinating kākāpō mating rituals, and the questionable but effective innovation that we like to call the sperm copter. Here in part two, we delve into some of kākāpō conservation's biggest wins, as well as the disappointments, the challenges, and all the continuous learning from managing such an intriguing, unusual species. We kick things off by asking Andrew a few of your listener questions. First up, how is climate change affecting the management of kākāpō?
That's a really, really good question. And we talked earlier in the previous episode about aspergillosis, this fungal pneumonia, which we think might have been exacerbated by some unusual climatic conditions, so a hot, dry summer. So that's one. That the disease is always an issue, and that's a real impact, a probable impact of climate change for many species. Another one is kind of a little bit unusual in that kākāpō breed in response to certain trees' mass fruiting. And that mass fruiting effect actually depends on temperatures, and in particular, temperatures from one summer to the next summer. So for example, with kākāpō, with the rimu trees, if we have a hot summer, then a cold summer, then we know 2 years later there's going to be a rimu mast. And with climate change, you might get greater temperature fluctuations. So you might be more likely to have a hot summer than a cold summer, which means you might get more rimu masts, and you might even get bigger rimu masts too. So there could possibly be a silver lining in that you might actually end up with some more kākāpō breeding and more bigger breeding seasons. We haven't confirmed that at all, but that's a hypothesis.
Next up is, how did the extinct North Island kākāpō compare to the South Island kākāpō?
We don't know a lot about that, actually. There's quite limited genetic samples from the North Island kākāpō. We think there may have been some genetic differences, but there was nothing too obvious in terms of any sort of morphological or behavioural differences. The North Island kākāpō went extinct earlier than the South Island kākāpō, so early 20th century, estimated between like the 30s and the 50s for the North Island kākāpō, whereas quite a bit later from the 70s to around about the 90s for the South Island kākāpō.
Okay. Can we tell from their DNA if they have clear Gondwanan origins, or is that passerine birds only?
We think that they're probably not Gondwanan. They split from their nearest relative. So this is actually the New Zealand parrots. So the kaka and the kia and the kākāpō all lumped together, had a common ancestor split about 55 million years ago, which is after the Gondwana split. And then kākāpō split from the kia and the kaka ran about 25 to 30 million years ago. So they've been isolated for quite a long time. So kākāpō, almost certainly had a flying ancestor. And then over those last 25, 30 million years have lost that power of flight.
Okay, because they didn't need it. Are they related to the Aussie night parrot?
Not really, no. The kākāpō are one of the oldest parrots. So that they've sort of branched that kākāpō on those New Zealand parrots, split off a long time ago, whereas the night parrot split off quite a lot more recently, around about 25 million years ago. And if you want a good visual demonstration of this, go to onezoom.org, where there's a tree of life that you can zoom in on and see how all of these species line up together. It's absolutely fascinating.
Ooh, I will definitely be doing that, and I bet everyone else will as well. Thank you, listeners. That was a wonderful round of listener questions. So in addition to low fertility, another big issue kākāpō are facing is running out of room. Can you tell me about that, and what is the plan for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's one of our biggest problems at the moment is space, because we've had these really big breeding seasons in succession, 2016, 2019, 2022, all record breeding seasons, and we've actually doubled the population since the start of 2016. So we have run out of room, probably a little bit more quickly than we were expecting. And so, yeah, finding new space is one of the main things. But the problem is that there aren't really many good places left. We've kind of got all the good predator-free islands. And so we're now looking at going to different places, and it's such an important goal to try and get more and more areas of predator-free habitat across the country.
We should mention too that conservation is a team effort and that there is a role for everyone. We work with many partners. Our most important relationship is with iwi. Tell me how your team work with Ngāi Tahu to safeguard such a taonga species.
Sure. And so that team effort thing is so important that, you know, we are a team of people. We've been standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, that cliche that people have gone by for decades and decades doing this work. So that's so, so important. And our partnerships are super important. And our partnership with Ngāi Tahu, we have a really good relationship with Ngāi Tahu. We work really closely, consult with them on all of the decisions that we make. We meet regularly. And it's kind of expanding and growing. So, for example, the recent translocation that we had to Mangatautri, there was a direct whanaungatanga agreement between Ngāi Tahu and the iwi at Mangatautri too, so that they're able to do that cultural aspect of that exchange of birds, as well as our practical conservation management side of it too. So yeah, I think this is a really exciting space, and it really helps us to grow our conservation efforts by working more closely with iwi.
Awesome. And you've got commercial partners too. Shout out to Meridian. I love that Meridian, in addition to funding support, often have their staff get to join you in the field. Is that right?
That is right. And that's been really, really critical. And we have some quite complicated power systems on our islands, for example. So we've recently got a lot of solar systems set up on our islands with batteries. And so we've got complete renewables on the islands, and just maintaining and installing and helping with those is a good use of these partnerships. They can use their expertise to help us in areas like that. So yeah, that infrastructure stuff, as well as the funding, is really important.
Brilliant. What's are kākā and kākāpō similar in the cheekiness? Like, will kākāpō try and, you know, get into the wires of things on the island?
They will. They do pull things apart. So yeah, we definitely have to kākāpō proof things on islands. They're not quite kia level, but they can be pretty destructive. And yeah, especially some of the young males, and some of the bigger males actually too, can just pull things apart when they want to.
Oh, okay. So thank you very much, Meridian, for your ongoing support. Andrew, can you tell me what your biggest conservation win in recent memory has been?
I think one of the biggest wins that we've had in recent years as a team has been the breeding seasons. We've had these really, really big breeding seasons, subsequent ones in a row, producing lots of chicks. And so we've kind of managed to increase the population massively over that time. So as I said before, it's doubled since the start of 2016. And that's a result of these big rimu masts, but with some quite careful management on top as well, to try and get the most out of all those eggs and chicks that come along. But I think what's really important from the breeding seasons, what I get excited about, is not how many chicks we produce, it's what we learn and how we change the management. And I mentioned before about having to step back a little bit and make the management of kākāpō less intensive. And this is the time we learn. So the breeding seasons are important, and they're really busy because that's when we get all the eggs. But it's also when we can try new things and we can test stuff and step back a little bit. And what happens if we leave eggs to hatch in nests, for example? Or what happens if we don't check that nest over there on that island for a month or more, which is what we did in the last breeding season? So it's a time to test and to prove our methods. So I think for me, that's one of the most rewarding things, and one of the areas that I think we've advanced quite a lot in certainly the last decade.
Yeah, you must get so much out of that. That would be fascinating. What's been, on the other side, what's been the biggest disappointment?
Think also back to breeding seasons, the 2019 aspergillosis outbreak, that disease outbreak. There was at a period where everything was going so well. It was coming towards the end of the breeding season, April. We were kind of to start to wind down, thinking, wow, this has been amazing. It's done really, really well. And then suddenly we noticed chicks started dying, and things started to go downhill. And, you know, we had film crews and we had bad weather, and we had to try and juggle lots and lots of people. So yeah, that was a tough one. But it was in a way, it turned into a good thing, because we had this amazing collaboration from so many people around the country and around the world to help us. So yeah, and then that turned into probably one of the best collaborations I've ever been involved with. We had, you know, I was working with human doctors from around the world to try and understand this disease. So yeah, that was quite a nice sort of positive aspect of social media. I met all these people on Twitter who basically pitched in to help from completely different fields, who had never been involved in conservation before. So yeah, I guess we turned that bad situation into a good one with the help of a lot of people.
Oh, and so many people would be very invested in it as well. Did you say that you took kākāpō to human hospitals?
Yeah, some of them have got scanned in human hospitals because there weren't enough facilities available, so they were put in the CT scanners. So, yeah, the vets who we work with are pretty amazing and go to huge lengths to help the Kakapo program. So, yeah, that's fantastic. And we've been getting more and more involved with having the vets in the field with us too, which is really great. We can actually treat birds on site, and we have a vet in our team now, Lydia, our vet too. So that's really, really key. So, yeah, those partnerships, it's all about that partnerships. So that's, as I get more into conservation, I kind of learn how important that is.
Awesome. You work in these incredibly remote areas, all the different islands. Do you have a pen knife or an essential item that's like a hack item you take with you all the time in the field?
Yeah, it's a bit of a boring one, head torch. I'd never be without a head torch in the field. Even if I'm out in the day, always take a head torch, and we'll always take a backup head torch as well when we do night work. Once I was carrying some very valuable eggs. There were gold standard eggs down a hill on Whenuaho, and from a nest, and my head torch failed, so I got out my spare, and then the spare failed too. So yeah, head torch is important. Since then I've kind of upgraded and actually was able to get someone to help there and came along and bought a spare head torch. But yeah, head torch is a bit of an underrated piece of kit. Trying to walk around in the dark without one is tricky.
It's a very good point. It's so simple, and yet if you don't have three with you, look what can go wrong. Speaking of things going wrong, Doc has expert planners and we go over things with a fine-tooth comb, but sometimes nature simply will nature. Can you think of another time where the best laid plans went awry?
Yeah, that happens. And as you say, we try to do everything to prevent it, but, you know, things always surprise us. And I guess a recent example is at Mangatau Tree, where we've released Kakapo in this fence sanctuary. So a mountain with a fence around it. The staff there installed this barrier, which we helped design, which basically we thought would stop Kakapo climbing the fence, because these fences are designed to keep animals out. They're not designed to keep animals in, especially Kakapo. So we put a barrier up to stop the Kakapo climbing the fence. And we knew there was a risk, but we always thought that, you know, there's a possibility of Kakapo might escape from the sanctuary. But it's happened to probably a little bit more than we thought. And so, yeah, I guess that's one thing where it hasn't gone quite to plan. But we're working with the team up there to try and adapt that and to try and make sure that we've blocked any possible escape routes. We think they may be climbing up trees and jumping over, and they might not even be knowing that they're going over the fence. But so that, I guess that's an example of how we try and adapt. And we're looking at technology solutions too to try and keep a closer eye on the Kakapo so we can detect exactly when they do cross the fence.
Okay. And what's something about nature, I mean, you must find this all the time, that just blew your mind when you learned it? We call these holy crap facts, and Doc staff have some really good ones. I'm sure you've got thousands.
Yeah, I'll try and, this is a slightly longer example, but I'll try and keep it brief. And I'll try and not to do one about Kakapo or Takahe. And what I did a bit of work for animal communication for my PhD. And one of the things that kind of blows me away is how good animals are at communicating and how we always big ourselves up of humans as these master communicators, but animals are pretty good too. An example I think is alarm call networks, which is, you might have noticed, and people will probably be familiar, if there's a cat around, then the blackbirds or the tui or the bellbirds will start going nuts and they'll make their alarm calls. But what we tend not to know is actually they have different alarm calls for different types of animals. They'll actually have different alarm calls for different species and for different size of animals. So, for example, birds will have a different alarm call for a large hawk compared to a small falcon flying through the forest. And so that's kind of, I think, a little bit crazy that they have this communication thing going on. But that actually is not just confined to single species. There's actually multiple species. So all species will use the same type of call. So all the birds know that same language. And it's not just confined to birds. It's actually confined to mammals too. So squirrels will pitch in. So as a hawk is flying through a forest, there'll be this network, this grapevine going ahead of it, around about 100 miles an hour of all the animals talking to each other so that it can know what that species is and what it's doing too. So if the bird is flying, if it's perched, there'll be different alarm calls. So I think there's some pretty sophisticated animal communication that we just don't fully understand. And I think we've got lots to learn.
That's something I'm going to be Googling straight after this. That's very exciting. How come it would be a different one to a falcon to a hawk if it's the same, you know, it's flying through?
Yeah, it's based on a threat, I think. That's the understanding of the threat it poses. And so different size animals, and whether it's perched or whether it's flying, it will actually pose a different type of threat. So, yeah, they have different types of call. And it's this fact that it's between species. Like, we tend very much just to speak within our own species. Mm. But animals, you know, communicating within dozens and dozens of species all using the same language, I think is pretty cool.
That's amazing and makes us feel a bit stupid. Is there a moment out in the field that stands out to you where you sort of stop and think, is this what I get to do for a living? Am I the luckiest biologist in the world?
Yeah, there's lots and lots of those. The basic one is flying over Fiordland in a helicopter thinking, wow, this is amazing. This is incredible. On the ground, other ones are putting kakapo chicks into nests. One of the things that we have done in the past is hatch them, kakapo chicks, in artificial incubators, and then you have to introduce the chick to the mother. So you sit and wait at the nest with this tiny little chick. You try and keep it warm, sometimes for hours, sometimes you have to feed it. The mother goes, you're waiting for the mother to leave the nest. When the mother leaves, you've got a short window to slip that chick into that nest, and then you watch on the video and watch as she comes back in, and what is she going to do? And I've had that before where the mother has never seen a chick in her life. She's had an egg, her first egg, and then you have to introduce a chick and what's going to happen. And I remember one case where the mother came in and she basically just kicked the chick across the nest and was throwing it around. And it was this, this tiny little 30-gram bundle of fluff. But luckily, she then started brooding it and looked after it and turned out to be an amazing mother rearing three chicks. So, yeah, they're the kind of things where you see things and you feel very, very privileged to be able to sort of witness that behavior, but also to be able to influence it and help out.
Oh, that must have you on tenterhooks when you're watching on the video going, be nice to it, please be nice to it. That's amazing.
Right. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning as well, and you haven't slept for a while and that sort of thing too. So there's always a bit of pressure going on.
Oh, now I know that some conservationists get a little bit grouchy about kakapo because they feel like they hog all the limelight. What do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something I've noticed. I think kakapo, the bird that the public love to love, and some conservationists kind of love to hate, because they do tend to take over a little bit. I think I definitely get the issue there. It is a problem. There's this whole charismatic megafauna issue that, you know, some some species get all the attention. But I think kakapo are actually a really good gateway species, is how I like to think of them. Ooh. They get people into conservation who wouldn't otherwise be. And I really, really notice that a lot. We get people interested and follow us who are not conservation people. You know, they might be tech people, or they might be artists or something. And they like the tech that we do, or they just get engaged because they see a kakapo video online, and then they learn about kakapo, and then they learn about the other species and some of those wider problems, you know, with the problems with predators, for example. And I've had that conversation so many times. So there is a danger that one species can take over, but I think there's definitely those flow-on effects.
I think kakapo is the gateway drug to the conservation world, is like the perfect thing.
I think that works well. And we're always mindful of the kakapo conservation. You know, how can we pay it forward? So the technology is a good example too. We develop technology that then can get used for other species as well. So yeah, we are not going to stop people loving kakapo. You know, I think that can only be a good thing.
Thinking back to your first ever day on the job, what advice would you give yourself now?
I would say you can probably never ask too many questions. Yeah, don't be afraid to say that you don't know stuff. And I kind of had a little bit of an excuse here, because I came from astronomy. I wasn't from a conservation background, so I had almost like free rein to ask lots of stupid questions. But yeah, I think that's really, really key. No one knows everything. And the people that you work with, the people that I work with, are absolutely incredible. We have so many people with so much varied knowledge, and you can always learn things by asking lots of questions.
And we're all still learning as well. Like you say, you're learning about management every breeding season. Yeah. Learning new things.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, it's just one species. There's so much that we don't know, and with so much more work to do. And that's obviously, you know, how can we best do that? How can we find out those things and apply them and help other species as well?
And if you hadn't discovered kakapo in this way of doing this job, what would you do? Would you go back to astronomy?
I think I'm pretty committed to conservation. Yeah, so I definitely will stay in conservation. I guess I've switched from one nocturnal career to another nocturnal career, from going from astronomy to kakapo. But when I was growing up, I had a love of astronomy and a love of nature and wildlife, and I've kind of moved into that. But it's quite nice, you know, when I'm up on a kakapo island at night, I can look up and see some pretty amazing stars and get my astronomy fixed that way too.
Ah, this sounds like the best job and the best life in the world. You're doing life correctly, Andrew. Thank you so much for being here. All of us in this room have learned so much, and I bet our listeners have as well. You can find Andrew on X or Twitter at Takapo Digs, and for all the dot goss, we are docgovnz on all platforms. If you liked what you heard, tell your friends, leave a review. Honestly, helping us get these stories out to the world really helps the kākāpō. So get to sharing. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time. I have loved talking to you. I hope you're prepared for the influx of job applications you're about to receive. Mine will be the top of the pile.
Thank you, Erica. It's been great. And I've been a long time admirer of the podcast, so it's great to be able to talk here. And just to everyone who's been listening, it's just, thanks for all the interest and support that we have for kākāpō. And if you want to do one thing to help kākāpō, just please tell a friend about them. Just spread the word. I think that's probably the number one thing. And so, thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Erica Wilkinson, and this has been the Doc Sounds of Science podcast. This show is available wherever you get your podcasts, or you can stream it off our website, doc.govt.nz. This show is produced by Jane Ramage, with editing by Lucy Holyoke. If you enjoyed this episode, show us some love with a 5-star rating.